Okay, let's get started. So I'm gonna start with the same two questions I start every class with. This is the last class I will ask these questions, because after this I'm gonna assume that you will find something. Who is not in a group yet? Anybody in the class who's not in a group? Everybody's in a group. Okay, good. So that question is done. I'm never asking that question again. So if you are not in a group and you haven't put up your hand, you have to find a group. Second, who's not picked a company yet? You're lying. Everybody in the class has picked a company? Is that right? Okay, good. Pick a company soon, right? The longer you put this off, the more work you can start getting done that you're not doing. Okay? So today's class, we're actually going to complete the trifecta when it comes to cost of equity. Let me explain what I mean by that. There are three numbers I need to get to a cost of equity. I need a risk-free rate. I need an equity risk premium. And I need a measure of relative risk. How risky your stock is relative to the average stock in the market. We've already said the risk-free rate is easy, right? You tell me what currency you do your valuation in, I'll tell you what the risk-free rate should be. It should be the risk-free rate in that currency. It's not based on where the company is incorporated, where it trades, but what currency you do the valuation. For the equity risk premium, what did we decide? What do you use? What should the equity risk premium for a company reflect? Not where it's incorporated, but where it does business, either with revenues or with operations. Today we're going to complete the cycle by looking at measuring relative risk. And of course, if you've taken a finance class, by now you've been, brainwashed. You've been told beta measures risk. So let's kind of nail down how much you truly understand betas. So if you've taken a finance class, beta comes from a regression, right? Returns on the stock against returns on a market index. In a textbook, it always looks so straightforward. Run the regression, get the slope of the line. My challenge today to you is a practical question. I'm sitting down to value Petrobras, the Brazilian oil company. I've decided to do the valuation in US dollars. You're saying, you can't do that. It's a Brazilian company. I can pick whatever currency I want. I'm going to value it in US dollars. So already we know the risk-free rate should be the US dollar risk-free rate. The equity risk premium should reflect where Petrobras has its reserves. Now comes the final question. I need a beta for Petrobras. I've run two regressions here. I pulled them both off Bloomberg. The first is a regression of Petrobras against the Bovespa. This is a local return regression, so it's in reais to run the regression. You've got a beta of 1.66. The second regression is a regression of an ADR. You know what an ADR is? That's actually a foreign stock listed in the U.S. that's traded in dollars. So it's in dollars. The returns are in dollars. Run the regression against the S&P 500, and I've got a beta from that regression. I have a very simple question. Doing this valuation, which of these two betas, if either, should I use in my valuation? Obviously, the number is going to be very different, right? 1.66 versus 1.98. It's going to give me a very different cost of equity. Which of those two betas should I use and why? Anybody want to give it a shot? Yeah. I've told you the currency. So the currency is dollars. So you think I should use the ADR regression? Do betas have currency units? And I say the beta is 1.98. Is it $1.98, $1.98?
No? It should be
a weighted average. So this way you cop out, right? So I pull that. Weighted average, weighted based on what?
Based on the revenue. So if it's earning more revenues in the United States, beta...
Oh, this is going to get really messy. So like an equity risk premium, I will now have to run... But what will I do with a company like Royal Dutch and their Nigerian operation? They don't have a Nigerian listing. That's going to be not just impractical, it's going to be really tough to do.
Beta is a source of market risk, so it depends on where it's actually operating.
But let's dig a little deeper, right? Let's first get rid of this currency issue. Let's suppose I asked each of you what your weight was in pounds. Don't worry, it's privacy. I won't ask you what the weight is. But let's say I did collected all the data. And I put it into a spreadsheet. I averaged the weight of everybody here in pounds. And then I divided each person's weight by the average. I'll call it a beta. Why not? It looks like a beta, right? So if your weight is exactly the average, you have a beta 1. If you're 20% above the average, your beta is 1.2. So I'll come up with a beta measure of your weight. Let's say I took the entire spreadsheet and I made each of you give you your weight in kilograms instead of pounds. I put that in, I averaged the weight, and then I computed each person's beta by dividing your weight in kilograms by the average for the class. What should I get? I should get exactly the same. So the first thing is betas are measures of relative risk. So currency goes away. So the fact that you're doing a dollar valuation or a peso valuation or a real valuation has nothing to do with what currency you should be using in your regression. This is a statistical way to pick, right? In statistics, what are we told? What's a better? Which of these two regressions is a better regression? What's a measure of a good regression? You look at the R-squared, look at the T-statistics, you look at the standard error. It looks like the Brazil regression is a much better regression because look at the R-squared and the standard. It looks much better. But let's dig a little deeper. Why is my Brazil regression so much better in statistical terms than my U.S. regression? What am I regressing? I'm regressing Petrobras against a market index, right? In Brazil, I'm regressing it against the Bovespa. In the U.S., I'm regressing it against the S&P 500. If you're a much, in which of these two indices is Petrobras a bigger part of? Is it a bigger part of the Bovespa or is it a bigger part of the S&P 500? It's going to be much bigger part. Now you see statistically why when I run a regression against a local index, it's always going to look better. I'll save you the torture. If I'm valuing Petrobras, I'm using neither of these regressions. They're both crappy regressions. And that's going to be what we talk about today. Why it's so dangerous when you value companies to go with a regression, one slice of history, and to trust that regression to tell you what the risk of the stock is. The onus is again on me now to tell you what I would use instead. But we're going to start with what the conventional practice in every finance class is. Run a regression, take the slope, that's your beta. And I'm saying in valuation, it's an extremely dangerous way to estimate the beta for a company. Okay? So this slide is already on your, I forgot to make copies, but it's on, you can download it from the webcast page. So let's go back to our lecture notes because I'm going to talk about the beta regression, why I don't trust it, and then I'm going to talk about what I'm going to use instead. So again, let's start with standard financial practice. The way I was taught betas and the way you were taught betas was exactly the same way. Run a regression of returns in the stock against returns in the market index. The slope of the line is a beta. Okay? I'm going to argue that that beta has three problems with it. The first is a statistical problem. If I run this beta regression right, it has to come with a big standard error. You can't do statistical tricks and try to make the standard error lower, and we're going to talk about why. The second is, this is a backward-looking number, right? Because how did I get the regression for Petrobras? I looked at the last 2 years, the last 5 years, whereas my valuation is about risk in the future. I'm using a beta from the past, and if my company has changed its business, has had issues, my beta regression might not reflect it. And the third is if my company's debt ratio is changing over time, if they're going from no debt to a lot of debt or a lot of debt to no debt, my regression is trying to hit a moving target. So let's start to dig a hole for regression betas and bury it deep. Because from this, after this class, I don't want anybody using a single regression beta in evaluation. So I want to make my case as strong as possible. Here's the first problem with the regression beta. We talked about noise, right? So I took GoPro. You familiar with GoPro? This is a camera for overactive overshares, basically, right? Where you go for a three-hour hike. You think I really want to go along with you on the hike, so you record everything you do, including some things I don't want to know about, and you put it on YouTube. Okay? But clearly, it's a company that is viewed as this growth company. It soared and then crashed. Okay? It's a risky stock, we'd all agree, right? I went to Bloomberg, I looked up the beta. Raw beta is 1.6. Well, that doesn't sound like a bad number, right? That sounds like it's within the realm. It's 1.6 times more risky than the average stock. But before you get too excited about the beta, go further down. What does it say about the standard error of the beta? It's about 0.50. Let's remember statistics. If I tell you that the regression beta is 1.60, and I tell you the standard error on that beta is 0.50, give me the range on your beta with a 95% confidence interval. 95% is two standard deviations. So if I asked you what's the beta for GoPro, based on this regression, what's your answer going to be? Somewhere between 0.6 and 2.6. Fat lot of good that does me in evaluation to know that, you know, GoPro could be less risky than the average stock or almost three times more risky. This is not GoPro's fault. It's the nature of the regression process, because what is the regression measuring? How your stock moves with the market. In the case of GoPro, what is it telling you? That most of the movement in the stock has nothing to do with the market. So you have a low R squared and a high standard error. So you look at that and say, well, I'm valuing GoPro. I don't know what beta to use. I don't blame you. This beta is complete noise. It's telling me nothing about what I should be using in my valuation. Again, I haven't told you what I'd use instead, but I'm saying a regression beta is definitely not what I'm going to be using. I also told you be very suspicious when your beta looks really good. This is one of my favorite beta pages of all time. It's a beta page I printed off for Nokia in early 2000. So I went to Bloomberg, so give me a beta for Nokia. Not only do I get a beta, look at the R squared, 94%. Look at every point, it's almost on the line. If this were a statistics class, I'd get a gold medal, right? So I took a look at the index. What is it there? Hex. I didn't even know there was an index. I thought there was a witch's curse until I ran the regression. You know what the hex is? It's a Helsinki exchange. You're saying, what the hell is Bloomberg doing going to Helsinki to run the regression? Why do they go to Helsinki? Because Nokia, Bloomberg is incredibly parochial about the way they estimate betas. You ask for a beta for a Finnish stock, they go to Helsinki. They run the regression against the hex. And I make a confession. I had no idea what was in the hex in early 2000. So I went and took a look, and I wish I hadn't. Nokia was 80% of the hex. So let me get this straight. You run a regression of Nokia against Nokia. You found an awful lot of the time the two moved together. How could they not? But this is one of the most meaningless numbers of all time, and here's why. I want to step back and go back to the core of what we talked about when we talked about measuring risk. We said risk is measured through the eyes of the investors in this company, the marginal investors in this company, right? So I went and took a look at the 17 largest investors in Nokia in early 2000. You know who was on top of the list? Barclays held Nokia as part of their global index fund. Think about it. Your marginal investor is a global investor. They hold your stock with hundreds of other global stocks. When Barclays measures Nokia's risk, which is the way we should all be measuring risk because we look through the eyes of the marginal investor, are they running this regression in their heads? In fact, to run this, if you wanted to stay with the regression, what's the index I should be using to get a beta for Nokia, given that their marginal investor is a global investor? I should be using some kind of a global index, the MSCI Capital Index. There are global indices. And when you do that, tell me what's going to happen to the regression. First, what's going to happen to the R squared? It's going to drop the standard. So that's what I mean about if you run a regression right, you're going to get a big standard error and a low R squared. It's a feature of this process, not a bug, because that's exactly what you're trying to capture, the portion of the risk that's market risk. So I don't trust my beta regression when it looks bad. I don't trust it when it looks good. That doesn't leave me a whole lot of space for me to trust my beta regression. And here's the third thing that worries me about betas. You run a regression, you pick a time period, right? If anything strange happened during that time period, it's going to show up in your beta. Okay? Take an example. One of the companies where I've cried over lost money is Valiant. I've talked about it. So I said, Valiant, you know, it's a company that's gone through all kinds of crises. Its CEO disappeared, then a new CEO shows up, and you know, you have legal scandal, all kinds of things. So if I think about risk, I'm thinking about all these risks mounting up, right? So I went to Bloomberg and said, give me a beta for Valiant, expecting to see a high beta. Instead, what I got as my regression beta was 0.36. It actually makes complete sense if you think about what a beta measures. Why is my Valiant beta so low? If they've gone through 2 years of crises and all kinds of bad things happening to them, how come the beta is so low? Yeah?
Because beta only measures the systematic risk. And what Valiant
Give me an intuitive term. You know, let's say I've never heard of the term systematic risk, market risk. Intuitively tell me why the beta is so low. In other words, let's say 24 months in a row, your stock goes down because you have one crisis after another crisis after another crisis after another crisis. So I look at the returns on your stock. It's down, 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 down. The market is going up and down depending on what's happened in the market. If I take a stock that goes down all of the time versus a market that's going up and down, guess what? The stock is not moving with the market. That's a correlation in the R squared. The beta is going to be low. But I'd argue you'd be crazy if you sat down to value Valiant today and said, I'm going to use a beta of 0.36. So this can happen if good things happen to your stock, if you have an acquisition bid for your stock that keeps pushing your stock price up. So Macy's beta is going to become more and more meaningless over the next 6 months as the acquisition kicks in and prices do. It's going to mean that if you have a stock like Valiant where bad things happen, the beta is going to... You're already starting to look more and more of your regression betas. You're knocking them off. If it looks good, throw it out. If it looks bad, throw it out. If bad things have happened to your company, throw it out. If good things have happened to your company, throw it out. And here's the final reason why I don't want you to go down this path. When we talked about bias, let's assume that you're valuing Bombardier. Somebody in this class is actually valuing Bombardier. Bombardier is a Canadian aerospace company. It makes smaller aircraft. In fact, it is Embraer's competitor in many markets. And you decide that you need a beta. But you're biased. Biased in what sense? You've already decided Bombardier is a disaster. You expect to find the stock to be massively overvalued. You go to Bloomberg and you print off two beta pages. One in US dollars for the ADR and one against the Canadian market. But now remember, this is not like the first case where you're making this reasoned judgment. You've already decided you think Bombardier is overvalued. Which of these two betas are you going to use in your valuation? Are you going to use a beta of 1.70, which is what you get with the US dollar regression of the 1.20? Which direction is your bias here? You want to push the value down because you're convinced that this is an awful company. You want to push the value down. You want to use a high beta or a low beta? You're going to go the high beta. You're going to pick the 1.70. You don't think this happens at investment bank after investment bank? You want to do an M&A valuation. You want to push up the value of the company you're valuing. You go into the Bloomberg room and you lock the doors. 25 minutes later, you emerge with a printed beta page. So this is the beta for your company. Really? How many pages do you look at before you pick this one? Because if you get a chance, sit in front of a Bloomberg terminal, you can change the starting point and the ending point for your regression. You can change the return intervals from daily to weekly to monthly to quarterly. You can change the index from the S&P 500 to the Dow 30 to the Morgan Stanley Cap. You can do whatever you want. And if you have enough time and you keep playing, you're going to find exactly the beta you wanted to get for this company. It defeats the whole point of risk assessment if you're going to search for a number that you wanted to see in your valuation. So I value about 50 companies a year. Okay? If you get a chance, I posted my Apple valuation. That's the first company valuation scene. It's a nice, comfortable company to value. There's not much growth in the future. So all you're debating is how much cash can this cash cow continue to give? That doesn't even make sense. You know, usually cows give milk. How much cash milk does this cash cow continue to give? So it's a very compact valuation in terms of disagreements, but I've actually taken my story about Apple and made it into a valuation. So if you get a chance, look at it, because I've also looked at the cost of capital. So you're going to be able to see what we've talked about in class in terms of risk premiums and betas play out there. Okay. So I value about 50 companies here. It's been 20 plus years since I've used a regression beta in evaluation. And that was in a moment of weakness. Okay. So what I'm trying to say is if I have to value a company, I can't visualize a scenario where I'm going to trust one slice of history and one regression to tell me what the beta of this company should be. Now, before we get further into what to replace betas with, it's amazing how many people have issues with beta in general as their measure of risk. And and I understand it. They're coming from a place where they say, this is not a good way to measure risk. And they have backing from big names. Warren Buffett has been famously quoted as saying that beta is useless, you shouldn't use it in evaluation, it doesn't make any sense. And if you go to Omaha to go to that value investing conference, beta will be the most condemned number in finance. But here's the mistake they make after they've made the decision. They decide that because they don't like betas, they can't do discounted cash flow valuation. And that makes no sense to me. If you don't like betas, I'm okay with that. Just tell me what you're going to use instead as your measure of risk. Because not liking betas doesn't mean you don't care about risk. If you tell me, because you don't like betas, risk doesn't matter, every company is equally risky, I don't get that. So if you don't like betas, tell me what you'd use instead. And I push, it makes people really pissed off that I push them on this. But when people say, I don't like betas, and there are some big name portfolio managers that have told me this, I say, okay, tell me why you don't like betas. And if you strip away all the verbosity that they come up with, it's one of two reasons. One is they don't like the assumption that the marginal investor is diversified. Because when you use betas, you're assuming that investors are diversified. All they care about is the risk that you cannot diversify with, which is okay. Because you could argue that in some emerging markets like Mexico or Brazil, the marginal investor might not be diversified. This might. So okay, I get it. So your first reaction might be, I don't like betas because the marginal investor is not diversified. I'll give you some ways of measuring risk which don't make that assumption. The other reason people don't like betas is it comes from what? Stock prices, right? You're saying, so what? Remember we drew the contrast between pricing and valuation? Valuation is about cash flows, growth, and risk, and pricing is about demand and supply. So this is actually a very legitimate point made by some value investors who say, if I'm interested in intrinsic value, why am I using a pricing measure of risk in an intrinsic valuation? Why are we using stock prices? Okay, I get that too. If your problem is with the pricing that I'm using to get it, I'll give you ways of measuring risk that don't depend on prices. So if you run into people, and I guarantee you, there will be people, especially when you first start working, who say, I've been working 20 years. You've been taught this beta stuff in school. It never works for us. We don't use it. Say, okay, why do you not like betas? This might get you fired, so ask it in a nice way. Because you want to get to the core of what exactly you'll be using instead of beta. So let's start with the diversified investor disagreement. You don't like diversified investors. I'll give you some ways, but you're okay with pricing. So basically, your problem here is, I don't like the diversified investor base. Here are measures of risk you could try instead of betas. In beta, what do I use as my measure of risk? I look at a regression, right? I'm looking at the portion of a variance that is due to the market, arguing that the rest is going to get diversified away. But let's assume that I don't want to make that assumption. I can just take your entire standard deviation as a stop. So let's say the standard deviation of IBM is 36%. And the standard deviation on average across the market is 40%. So basically, I'm just taking standard deviations. I'm not running regressions. See how I can convert that to a number that looks like a beta? IBM standard deviation is 36%. The average for the entire market is 40%. 36% divided by 40% gives me a 0.9. It's not quite a beta, but it's a measure of relative risk where I'm saying if you're a very risky stock like GoPro or Valiant, where the stock moves a lot, I'm going to give you a much higher measure of relative risk. I'm not making any assumptions about diversified investors. I'm focusing on total risk. Here's a second choice, and this is a choice that essentially got into being in the 80s when we had more access to data. And the drivers of this particular school of thought were Gene Farmer and Ken French, two professors of the University of Chicago. They said, it's true, CAPM binds you with all these assumptions. Why do we want to build up these risk and return models based on elaborate assumptions? Let's just look at the pricing and see what investors seem to be pricing in. In other words, what kinds of companies do they see as risky or safe? Sounds like it's, you know, complex, but here's what they did. They took every traded stock in the U.S. and they looked at the returns on every stock going back to 1962. Then they looked to see what kinds of companies seem to earn high returns. They found that small market cap companies seem to earn much higher returns than large market cap companies. They found that low price to book stocks earn much higher returns than high price to book stocks. And then they made a leap of faith. They said if small market cap companies earn higher returns, they must be riskier than large. See the leap of faith there? You're assuming that markets over time must be doing the right thing. They use the size of the company as a proxy for risk. They use the price to book ratio as a proxy for risk. It's very agnostic. You're not using any risk and return model. You're saying if that's what markets care about, that's what I should be pricing in. And in fact, since then, you've had more and more variables added to these proxy models. Earnings momentum, price momentum, all going in, essentially coming up with ways of coming up with expected returns. In fact, one way in which people meld these models with a CAPM is in many valuations. Here's what you will see. You'll see risk-free rate plus beta times equity risk premium. That's a CAPM. And then you see a small cap premium. So what the heck is that? That's a proxy model married to the CAPM saying, you know what, I'm going to bring in the fact that small companies have earned 3% more than large companies, therefore I'm adding it in. Okay. We'll talk about that practice, but that's essentially a kind of combination of a proxy model with the CAPM. And finally, there are, as I said, the CAPM model added on. So these are all models where you're not tied to the original CAPM, but the assumption is marginal investors are diversified. So if your problem is investors being diversified is too strong an assumption for you, I'll come in with something that fixes that. Let's say your problem is with stock prices. Yep, okay. If you don't like stock prices, I've got to use something else as my measure of risk, right? What's the most logical thing to focus on? If I'm not going to use stock prices to measure how risky companies are, what's my next best bet? If it's all about intrinsic value and fundamentals, maybe I can look at how volatile your earnings are over time, right? So if you're a company that's safe, maybe you have nice, stable earnings. If you're a company that's risky, maybe your earnings move around. So the first measures of risk here look at the variability in accounting earnings. In my view, you've jumped out of the frying pan into the fire. Here's why. When I looked at risk with stock prices, it's true stock prices are noisy, but I could look at stock prices every day, every hour. I could slice and dice the data to get more data into. How often do accounting earnings get measured at companies? With U.S. companies, it's 4 times a year. With some foreign companies, it can be 2 times or even 1 time a year. You see the problem here? You can use accounting earnings, but you're going to have these really small sample sizes. So if you're okay with that, I'm okay with it too. So if you decide that Con Ed has variability in earnings of only 10% and the typical U.S. company has 20%, you can divide the 10 by the 20. So basically, you're looking at earnings variability, coming up with something that looks like a measure of risk. There are some who prefer balance sheet ratios as a measure of risk. I don't know whether you've heard of Altman Z-scores. Altman Z-scores measure default risk, but there are other scores like it where you take numbers out of the balance sheet. How much debt? What's your debt ratio? How much working capital? So what they do is they take these accounting ratios, they plug them in, they come up with a number that is a measure of risk. But again, it comes with its own grains of salt, right? These are accounting numbers. Strange things can happen. But if you don't want to use prices, that's the first path you go down, accounting numbers. There are some people who say, well, I don't want to use earnings. I don't want to use prices. Now you're getting pushing yourself into a corner, right? Because now if you don't want to use earnings and you don't want to use prices, what are you going to use instead? There are Value Line, actually, which is a very old investment newsletter, actually breaks companies down into 5 classes. Class 1, Class 2, Class 3, Class 4, Class 5, riskiest to safest. They basically use a combination of things to make a judgment. If you're a tech company, you must be risky. It's very subjective. But you know what? I'll take what I can get. If you don't like betas, you don't like accounting earnings, and you want to use this 1 through 5 measure of risk, I'm okay with that too. That's better than not adjusting for risk at all. And finally, there are some people who actually look at the one number that you can observe in a company. We can observe the rate at which companies can borrow money at. So if you can observe that companies can borrow money at 8%, they say, well, the equity must be more expensive because you're behind the line, behind the debt guy in line. So they take the cost of debt you have as a company and use it as a way of coming up with cost of equity. What I'm trying to say is don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's one of the most hideous sayings of all time because I see visions of babies flying out of windows. Okay? But basically, if you don't like betas, don't abandon all of discounted cash flow valuation. Just come up with a different way of measuring risk, and the rest of the process will flow through. So now let me give you a very quick background. So I'm back to betas now, because as I said, I've looked at these options. They don't work for me. I don't trust accounting earnings. They're too few in number, and accountants smooth them out all the time. I don't trust these 1 through 5 risk measures because I don't trust myself to put the companies I want in the right places. I go back to beta in spite of all of its faults. But rather than use a regression beta, here's what I'm going to start with. I'm going to do a very quick review of something we spent almost 2 sessions, or a session at least, in the corporate finance class doing, which is looking at what is it that determines the beta for a company. Betas don't come from regressions. They come from choices you make as a company. So if you've taken my corporate finance class, this is a pure review. If you haven't, you're going to get everything you need. Your beta as a company is determined by 3 choices you make as a company. The first is, tell me what you do as a company. What kind of business are you in? What kind of products and services do you provide as a company? And here's why I'd care. The more discretionary your product or service is as a company, the higher your beta will be as a company. And think of why. Betas measure how you move with the market and the economy. So if you produce, you know what I mean by discretionary, if your customers can live without your product, they can delay buying it, you'll have a higher beta than if I can't do that. So if you produce goods that people can delay buying, defer buying, your beta will be higher than if you produce goods that people need. And I'll give you an example that I probably used in my corporate finance class because it brings home, I think, the basis for betas very easily. We talk about retailers, right? We talk about betas for retailers. Let's suppose I take retailers and I break them down into three groups: luxury retailers, department stores, and discount retailers. I don't show you any regressions, but then I ask you a question. I've given you three groups of retail companies. Which of these three groups is going to have the highest beta? What's your answer to that? Luxury retailers, department stores, and discount retailers. Which one's going to have the highest beta? Just think about what I just said. Luxury, and why? Because you can live without those Gucci's. Trust me. Those Prada's that you say, I cannot be without them. You're going to be okay. You're going to survive by hook or by crook. Luxury retailers will have the highest betas because in bad times, people will put off buying them. Department stores will be in the middle. And discount retailers, you need those underwear, I'm sorry to say, in good times or in bad times, maybe more in bad times. So you're showing up at Walmart in good times and bad times. And it shows up, if you look at the revenues for luxury retailers, they swing around a lot more as a function of the economy than discount retailers do. Say grocery stores. Do you expect them to have high betas or low betas? Low betas. Why? Because you need food, right? But what about Whole Foods? I mean, let's face it. You don't want to pay four times the regular price for eggplant unless you feel really flush with cash. If you're not that flush with cash, organic, inorganic, I'm going to die anyway. What's the difference? I'll get it at Pathmark or ShopRite. So you'd expect Whole Foods to have a higher beta than traditional grocery stores. So if you look at the grocery business, it's actually very interesting. 95% of the business is all this generic, low-margin, non-discretion product. Then you got Whole Foods and Sprouts, basically sticking out like, you know. Have you ever been in Sprouts? It's a California-based, you know, organic food store. They have bins of grains. Don't take a whole bag of that grain. You come out, you're going to be bankrupt. They weigh it and it's like $500 a pound or something. But it's basically, you can see even within businesses, variations across the businesses. So that's the first thing. So already I want you to, you said you don't, most of you picked a company already, right? I want you to think about your company. Forget about the regression beta. I want you to think about what product or service it provides and where you think this falls in the discretionary, non-discretionary scale. In fact, in econ, we have a word, we have at least a set of words we use to describe this, to measure this, right? What do we call it? Discretionary, non-discretionary? Come on. Econ 101. Elasticity of demand, remember? That's basically it. The more elastic the demand for your product and service is, the higher your beta will be for a company. Any questions on that? Okay. Let's move to the second thing. Tell me something about your cost structure. The greater the proportion of your costs that are fixed costs, the higher your beta will be as a company. Why? What does having a lot of fixed costs do to you as a company? In good times, you make lots of money. In bad times, you lose lots of money. Everything gets magnified. So if you're a company with a very high fixed cost structure, I would expect you to have a higher beta than if you don't. I use the example of airlines, again, in my corporate finance class, because a typical airline has huge fixed costs. You lease the aircraft, and, you know, you pay your employees the same because you're a unionized airline. Your fuel cost is pretty much fixed once you get the schedule. 95% of your costs are fixed. That's why, for airlines, it's always feast or famine. I've never seen airlines have a normal year. They're either making billions or they're going bankrupt. Okay? That's the nature of high fixed costs. So if you're in a business with a lot of fixed costs, I would expect you to have a higher beta than if you have lower fixed costs. So look at your company again. Think about what it does, what kind of cost structure it does. And the third and final question I'm going to ask you is, how much have you borrowed? And why does it matter? Because when you borrow, you create a fixed cost you did not have until you borrowed, which is interest expenses. You got to make the interest expenses in good times. But unfortunately, you have to make it in bad times too. So equity earnings become more volatile. That's it, three questions. By the time you finish answering those three questions, I should be able to give you a sense at least of whether you'll have a high beta, low beta, or an average beta. What business are you in? Is it discretionary, non-discretionary? What does your fixed cost structure look like? How much have you borrowed? That's it. You don't need to look at a regression. You have an intuitive way of working towards that number. That's the insight I'm going to use to kind of bypass regression betas. I'm going to try to come up with a beta for a company without ever looking at a regression. Actually, let me take that back. Without ever looking at a regression for that company. I'm going to start off by looking at the business you're in and giving you a beta for the business. Remember, betas measure exposure to the market. It's supposed to measure macroeconomic risk. Who you are as a company shouldn't matter. So I'm going to start off with a beta of the business you're in. Then I'm going to adjust the beta for the fact that your cost structure might be very different than everybody else in the business. Maybe you're Southwest Airlines and you have a more flexible cost structure than the rest of the airline business. I might reward you with a lower beta. You have a question?
Yeah. How would you ensure that your beta is accurate if you're one of the most mature companies in the industry? And then for your comps, for your industry, most betas are higher because they're less mature.
Okay. There are two questions there. One is, how do you ensure that your beta is accurate? Please, let's not use the word accurate in the rest of this class. Okay? Because in valuation, accurate is a tough standard. If you said it, you're going to punish yourself for reasons you shouldn't be. I'm going to make my best estimate. So let's say, how do I get my best estimate for a mature company in a sector where there aren't that many mature companies, or there are lots of mature companies?
Well,
let's
say it's the most mature.
If the most mature is not a problem. For instance, if I take the tech business, there are enough mature tech companies now that if I did Apple, I can find enough. I'll tell you when a mature company becomes a problem. If you're the only mature company in a sector where everybody else is, can we use the word immature? Not quite mature. Then we have a problem. I'll give you the classic example of that is Amgen. What business, what sector is Amgen in? It's in biotechnology, but it is the only large mature biotech company. Every other biotech company is with a small startup. I will be valuing Amgen in a few weeks. I ran into that problem. I looked at the biotech beta and said, this isn't going to fit Amgen. But to me, when you think about mature biotech, what's so mature about Amgen? They have lots of established drugs that are providing cash flows and earnings, and most biotech companies don't, right? And to me, the only difference between biotech and pharmaceutical companies in the U.S. is where you're in the life cycle. So Pfizer, Upjohn, etc. are mature pharmaceutical companies, but basically... So I actually used the pharmaceutical sector beta for Amgen because I felt the sector didn't fit. So I might do the same thing for Amazon. If I look at online retailing, I might say, this is not just another online retail company. This is a retail giant. It's going to have $300 million in revenues. Maybe I should be looking at regular retail companies. So I feel no qualms about defining my business narrowly because... No, or expansively, because I want more companies. So when I do the examples, we'll work through some examples of this, because I have 42,668 companies in my global sample. I will be able to find companies if I start expanding my sample a little bit. Yeah. Go ahead. I'll come to that. When I take that stage, I'll actually show you what I'm assuming and what to do if you don't like those assumptions. Because it does make some very strict assumptions about who bears the risk in a company. But when I get to that stage, in four slides, I'll actually look at the alternatives. So first step in the process, I'm going to look at the business you're in. I'm going to come up with the beta for the business. You say, how the heck are you going to do that? Leave that to me. Then I'm going to try to adjust that beta for the fact that you have more or less fixed costs, if I have that information. And the third step, I'm going to try to adjust that beta for the fact that you might have a very different policy on debt than everybody else in the sector. This is called a Hamada beta. It's been around 35 years. It makes some very strong assumptions about what debt is and how much risk debt bears. We'll talk about that and we'll talk about alternatives. So let's start with the first step. Okay? You have a beta for the sector. You should be adjusting for operating leverage, right? That said, I almost never do it, and here's why. To get the measure of operating leverage, I need to know what the fixed costs are and variable costs are, not just for my company, but for every company in my sector. So let's make this real. Let's suppose I want to adjust Southwest beta for the fact that they have lower fixed costs than a typical airline. So I need to know how much of Southwest costs are fixed, how much are variable. And I need to know fixed and variable costs for United, for American, for Delta, for every other airline. I challenge you to go to the financial statements of any of these companies and find fixed and variable costs. Because accountants don't classify costs as fixed and variable, right? They have cost of goods sold. They have SG&A expenses. I can try to guess what's fixed and what's variable, but it's very difficult to get that raw data. Can they do it? Sure, if they wanted to. In fact, if I were able to get fixed and variable costs for every single company in my sector, I could adjust betas for operating leverage just like I do financial leverage. In fact, this equation that you see here is actually a very simplistic equation where I start with an airline business beta, and then I adjust for the fact that a fixed and variable cost, and that ratio can be lower for Southwest and higher for American. Which the problem we face is an informational problem. So when you see me use a steel business beta for a steel company, it is true I'm implicitly assuming that the fixed cost structure for steel companies are all alike. But the reason I'm not adjusting is I don't have the raw information yet to make that adjustment. Now let's talk about financial leverage. The traditional equation, the Hamada equation for beta, which you saw in corporate finance, which you see used, makes the assumption that all of the market risk in a company is borne just by the equity investors. I'll give you a very simplistic example. Let's suppose you have a business or a company in a business with 100 units of risk. So this comes from your operating business. You have 100 units of risk. You have no debt. You have 100 shares outstanding, each trading at a dollar. So basically, you have 100 shares, 100 units of risk. Each share is going to bear one unit of risk, right? One share, one unit. Now, let's say you decide to borrow $50 and buy back stock. So basically, you're now $50 of debt, 50 shares. So basically, 50 shares are gone. How many units of risk do you still have? You still have 100. It's the same business. But now in the Hamada equation, those 100 units of risk will be borne by only 50 shares, which means your beta went from being one unit of risk to 2 units of risk. You're saying, how come the debt holders are not bearing risk? The Hamada equation was derived on the assumption that lenders might have default risk, but they don't bear market risk. Is it a strong assumption? Yes, especially when you get to double B, single B, triple C rated companies. If you think about what junk bonds do, they behave like shares, right? They start to have equity risk in them. Does that bother me? Yes, when I get to really high debt ratios. Does it bother me enough that I'm actually going to change my equation? Most of the time, not. But if you really feel that this is where you're getting stuck, that this assumption that lenders don't bear any risk is what's getting in the way, there is a way in which you can adjust your beta for what you think lenders will bear. So let me take that example. You have 100 units of risk. You bought back stock and 50 units of risk. I'm sorry, now only 50 shares. But let's assume that lenders now bear some of those 100 units of risk. Why? Not because they want to, but because you put it on their shoulders. They take 20 units of your risk away from you. That means your remaining shareholders will now have to bear only 80 units of risk. It's effectively going to lower your beta. But to do this, here's what you need. You now have to estimate a beta for your debt, just like you do for equity. In fact, I have a table in my Applied Corporate Finance book, which if you still have, you might have sold it back already, but if you still have it, you go and look. Based on your rating, I've come up with beta. So if you're a triple B rated company, for instance, that's like a beta of 0.15. A triple C rated company, that's like a beta of 0.6. So what that'll mean is some of the risk now is going to be borne by the lenders. The beta for your equity will now be lower at the highest debt ratios because you're sharing the risk. So the fundamental equation doesn't have to change, but you can adapt it if you're willing to come up with more information. You're saying, what's that 1 minus T doing in there? What's this 1 minus T doing in there? When you borrow money, it is a fixed cost, right? That interest expense. But what's the little bonus you get when you have that interest expense? You get a tax deduction. That's what the 1 minus T is. So the government is putting its arm over your shoulder saying, oh, don't worry so much. We'll take 40% of the burden. That reduces the risk you face as an equity investor. So those are the implicit assumptions you make every time you use this equation. Most of the time, I'm okay making those assumptions. So if you came to me with a company with a tremendous amount of debt and a triple C rating, then I might use this adapted equation because then you might be overestimating your cost of equity. So here's the process by which I estimate betas. So you play the role of somebody who has a company, and you come to me and say, look, I want a beta for my company. I'm not going to ask you for past prices and a regression, but here's what I'm going to start with. I'm going to ask you what business or businesses you're in. That should be a question that any company should be able to answer. You tell me, okay, so let's make up some businesses. You want to make up some businesses? You just create a company. Make up some businesses you're in. Make it a fun business. How about the casino business and the tobacco business? I don't want to make you a vice kind of guy, but no. Does it sound like good businesses? You say headquartered in Macau. We'll make it tobacco and casinos. Two businesses. I don't want to, you want something more solid like steel and chemicals? I'll go with that too. Yeah. Either. So let's suppose you're in two businesses. Tobacco and casinos. I said, okay, I'll be back tomorrow. And here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go back to my office and find as many publicly traded tobacco companies as I can and as many publicly traded casino companies as I can. They're publicly traded. What can I see for each of them? I can see a regression beta for each of them. Hang in there. You're saying, you don't like regression betas. I needed to get started. So I have 100 tobacco companies, 100 casino companies. I get 100 regression betas and 100 regression betas, right? I get an average. I now have an average casino company beta and an average tobacco company beta. I'm almost there, but there's one little thing that I have to adjust for, which is a typical tobacco company might have 10% debt. A typical casino company might have 80% debt. And you might have a very different debt ratio. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take out the effect of debt from those betas. It's called unlevering the beta. When I'm done, I'm going to end up with a beta for being, an unlevered beta is basically a beta for being in the tobacco business, not a beta for a tobacco company anymore, and a beta for being in the casino business. Then I come back to you and say, okay, you told me you're in two businesses. How much value do you get from each business? Your first reaction might be, I don't know how much value I get, but I get 80% of my revenues from tobacco, 20% from casinos. I take a weighted average of the two unlevered betas. I now have an unlevered beta for your company. What's the last step? I ask you, do you have any debt? If you say, no, I'm done, your beta for the company is now going to be that unlevered beta. But if you do have debt, I'm going to adjust for that debt with that Hamada equation, and I'm going to end up with a levered beta for your company. And if I want to introduce an intermediate step to adjust for operating leverage, I'm flexible enough to adjust for the operating leverage, but this is going to give me a beta for the company. Now let's step back. Why am I doing all of this? Because I don't like regression betas, right? Where did I get the 100 tobacco companies' betas? I got them from regressions. All I'm doing is replacing one regression beta with an average of 100 regression betas. How is that helping you? Remember that GoPro regression? Horrible regression, right? What was the standard error? 0.50. Let's say I have 100 companies just like GoPro in my sample. Each has a standard error of 0.5. You know what the standard error of the average of the 100 betas is going to be? 0.5 divided by the square root of the number of companies in your sample, which is 100. Square root of 100 is 10. Magically, I've taken 100 crappy betas, I put them in a pot, I've stirred them up, I pulled the average out. The average is magically precise. Thank God for the law of large numbers. Without it, we'd perish in valuation. The biggest advantage of using a bottom-up beta is that beta is going to be far more precise than any individual regression beta. That's why I go with bottom-up betas, and it gives me maximum flexibility. If you entered the tobacco business yesterday, there's zero chance I could have used a regression beta because it's not going to reflect what you did yesterday. But if I am computing the beta for your company, not only can I reflect what you did yesterday, I can be proactive. You tell me you're going to be in the chemical business a year from now, not a problem. I can bring it in, come up with a beta for your company. Bottom-up betas essentially give you back control over the beta. It's no longer a number coming from Bloomberg or Barr. It's a number that you compute reflecting your story for the company. In my Apple valuation, I'm telling a story about Apple. In my story, Apple is not just a smartphone company, but it's a company that's going to continue to get 75% of its value from smartphones. That's my story. So when I did my beta, I did a beta reflecting 75% from a smartphone business, a beta for the smartphone business, and that goes into my cost of capital. In the valuation of the week, I tell you, tell me your story for Apple, because some of you might have a different story. You might say, you know what? I think Apple is going to be in the electric car business. It's all this talk you're hearing, right? Okay, it's your story. Go on, carry it to its logical extreme. You go into the electric car business, that's going to give you a bump up in revenues. It's a big market. It's probably going to push down your margins, because the margins in the car business are nothing like the margins in the software business or in the smartphone business. You know what else is going to change? When I do your beta as a company, I now have to reflect the fact that a chunk of your value is going to come from the automobile business, and I then can compute a beta based on that story. It allows you to take your story and play it out in every number rather than be trust with historical data. So let's try a couple of companies, see how this plays out. The first company for which I'm going to estimate a beta is a Brazilian mining company called Vale. It's an iron ore mining company. That's actually the heart of what it does. And you can see that iron ore is a big chunk of its value. It's in three other businesses: metals and mining, fertilizers and logistics. You're saying, where do you come up with these businesses? Most companies, if you look at their annual report in 10K, will break their businesses down. And Vale broke themselves down into four businesses. So here's what I needed to do. I needed to get a beta for each business. So for each of these businesses, I went looking globally. You're saying, why don't you just stay in Brazil? What's the trade-off here? If I stay just in Brazil, I might get more companies just like, you know. But the problem is your sample size is going to be much smaller. And what does the law of large numbers require? Large numbers, right? It's not the law of small numbers. So if I have only three companies, I don't get the law of large numbers working in my favor. And remember what we said, betas have no currency. I can travel across the world. And look at how big my sample is. When I look at chemical firms for fertilizers, I have 693 companies. That is large numbers. Okay? And I do that for each of the businesses. I get an unlevered beta for each of the businesses by looking at publicly traded companies in each space. And here's the final step. To get the weights to put on these businesses, I start with the revenues that Vale reports for each business, which they do in their financials. But then I use the publicly traded companies I have to estimate what a dollar in revenues is worth in each business. You say, what does that even mean? In the metals and mining business, a typical company trades at 1.97 times revenues. And I do that for each business. What does a company in this business trade at? What that captures is some businesses are more valuable than others, some have higher margins than others. It allows me to come up with a value judgment that, based on my numbers, suggests to me that Vale is about 76% iron ore, about 16.7% metals and mining, about 5% fertilizers, and about 1.76% logistics. You see, this is such a pain in the neck. Thank God you're not doing GE. You know how many businesses there would be on that list? You'd have like 22 businesses. And with GE, you have to do it. You know why? Because they're starting to sell businesses off. And if your job is to value the appliance business for sale, you need to get that beta for the appliance business. This is part and parcel of multi-business companies, is to break it down. Those are the weighted average I get across the four businesses with those weights is 0.844. So if you ask me what the beta for Vale is as a company, my unlevered beta, the beta that I'll start with, is 0.844. I applied a debt-to-equity ratio for those betas. I used the same debt-to-equity ratio for five businesses, partly because I was lazy, partly because I had no information otherwise, and partly because these are all capital-intensive businesses. If you want to see a contrast, if you go and look at my corporate finance class session 11 or so, or session 10 from last year, it's online, you can pull it up. I did this for Disney, and Disney actually had to be a lot more careful. What businesses is Disney in? Let's go down the list. What's its biggest business? Entertainment is kind of the overall area. Let's break it down within the entertainment business. Broadcasting is its biggest business. ESPN is about 40% of Disney's value. So broadcasting is the biggest business. The next business, biggest business is their theme park business. The next biggest business is their movie business, which includes Marvel, Pixar, etc. The next biggest business is their theme park business. And then they have two little tangential businesses, at least last year. One was their consumer products business, which is mostly a licensing business. And they had an interactive gaming business until last year, which is where they were trying to come up with new apps and new. That business has now been shut down. But if I were doing Disney, I can't assume the same debt ratio for these five businesses because these are five very different businesses. The theme park business is a big infrastructure investment business. Think about California Adventure. They've spent $1.5 billion. Already, there are probably another billion coming up. And at the other extreme, you have broadcasting, very lightly capital intensive. So there I had to be a little more careful about allocating debt across the businesses. Here I didn't even bother. So here's what I have. I have a levered beta for each of the businesses and a levered beta for Vale as a company. I have a lot more faith in this number than running a beta for Vale's ADR against the S&P 500 or Vale against the Bovespa because this comes from the bottom up. It comes from the businesses you're in. And in fact, if you asked me to come up with the cost of equity for Vale at the time that I did this, the risk-free rate I used was a US dollar risk-free rate. Why? Because I was doing my valuation in US dollars. The beta that I have is this levered beta. The equity risk premium reflects what? Where Vale does business. And guess what Vale's biggest market is? Come on, you know the answer to that. Any question you don't know the answer to, what did I say you should say? China. Okay, you got it. It is Vale's biggest market, right? And that 7.38% is a weighted average of the different markets it's in. Everything has a place in your cost of equity. Your risk-free rate reflects your currency choice. Your beta reflects the businesses you're in. Your equity risk premium reflects the geography of your businesses, where you do business. Just keep everything in its place. It's going to be okay. So let me try one other company so you can get a flavor of what to do when you run into a sampling problem. I wanted a beta for Embraer, another company I'll be valuing. Here again, I started aerospace. I started Brazilian aerospace. Embraer is the only Brazilian aerospace company. I tried Latin American aerospace. Embraer is the only Latin American aerospace company. Almost by default, I had to go to global aerospace companies. The unlevered beta for global aerospace companies was 0.95. I use the debt-to-equity ratio for Embraer, and I come up with a levered beta using the debt-to-equity ratio of 1.07. I want to draw a little contrast here because for those of you who are going to go back and work in Europe or Latin America or even in Asia, in the U.S., it's conventional practice. You use gross debt-to-equity ratios. You take the total debt and divide by equity. In Europe and Latin America, they will often net cash out against the gross debt. It's called the net debt. If you use the net debt ratio for Embraer, you actually get a negative number. You think that is absurd. How much debt does Apple have right now? About $100 billion. You think that's a lot. How much cash does it have? $250 billion as of the last 10Q. So what's its net debt? 100 minus 250 minus 150. Get used to it. There are lots of companies with negative net debt ratios. You want to do net debt ratios, you got to stay with the negative number. You can't selectively lop it off at zero, saying, I'm not comfortable using negative numbers. Use a negative net debt ratio. Your levered beta will actually be lower than your unlevered beta. It's okay. It's okay. Don't freak out about it. It's completely reasonable because you got cash weighing the beta down. So all I'm saying is if you don't like gross debt ratios, which is what I use, you want to use net debt ratios, just use them all the way through. Not just in your levered beta, but in your new cost of capital, everything will kind of work out to be the same number at the end if you're internally consistent. So let's summarize on the cost of equity. Your risk-free rate has to be in the currency that you've decided the valuation. Okay? Your risk premium, you have a choice, historical or implied. I've already given you my bias. I prefer implied premiums because they're updated, they reflect what's going on. And if you have country risk, that's a place to show it. And for a beta, I prefer bottom-up betas. I don't like regression betas. They're too noisy. One slice of history, bad things can happen to you very quickly. So those are the three numbers you need to get to a cost of equity for a company. So if you get a chance, take a look at Apple's cost of equity. My risk-free rate is the T-bond rate. Why? Not because Apple's a U.S. company, but because I'm doing my valuation in U.S. dollars. My beta reflects the three businesses I see Apple in my story. That's a smartphone business, the computer business, and the services business. Services business includes not just the retailing is in there, it's primarily a smartphone business. And my equity risk premium, I reflect the regions of the world Apple is in. Its biggest market is not China, it's North America. But China is one of the largest markets Apple has outside the US, and it's growing. Okay. So that's the way all these numbers come together in a cost of equity. Any questions on the cost of equity? Yes.
So what if
when you do the averaging across companies? What does the law of large numbers allow you to do? Be incredibly sloppy and get away with it. And here's what I mean by it. If you have only one chance of getting a beta, you run one regression, time horizon matters. Two-year betas can be very different from five-year betas. Weekly betas can be very different from monthly betas. But once I start averaging across 693 companies, guess what? It doesn't matter whether I use two or five, whether I use the S&P 5. And that's, again, one of the gifts you get from bottom-up betas is you no longer have to spend time on those decisions where there's really no right answer. And I see analysts spending hours and hours on beta choices. What index should I use? Should I run the local? Just let it go. You have far more critical things you should be spending your time on evaluation rather than those choices. Yes? Okay, this is actually a good question. How large does your sample have to be before the law of large numbers kicks in? Let's do some basic statistics, right? I said with 100 companies, your standard error is one-tenth what it was with one regression. With 49 companies, I'm choosing numbers, you should be able to do the square root in your head, it should be one-seventh. With 25 companies, you can see that there's a lot of when I get from 1 to 4, I'm having my standard error. When I go from 4 to 9, I'm reducing it by two-thirds. So by the time I get to 9, I've actually reduced my standard error by about two-thirds. If I can go from 9 to 25, I reduce it. So you get to about 9, 10, maybe even 15, you're getting a big chunk of the law of large numbers working in your favor. So obviously you'd like larger samples rather than bigger samples, but if your sample size is 2, you have a problem. If you have 21, you're perfectly okay. And if you can't get enough companies in your sample, either expand your definition of the business to bring in other companies, or go geographic, go global. So if you're trying just U.S. companies, just change it to U.S. and European companies, and U.S., European, and Asian companies. I guarantee you, there's no company I've ever valued where I said, I can't find any comparable companies. I just have to try a little harder. So let's start on the last piece of this puzzle. We now have a cost of equity. Let's talk about bringing in the other way you can raise capital, which is debt. So I need a cost of debt. And the cost of debt is in many ways far simpler to handle than the cost of equity. So I'll give you what we're trying to estimate in the cost of capital. The cost of debt is the rate at which I can borrow money long-term today. Two key words, long-term and today. What I'm saying is I don't care if you decide to borrow six-month, one-year loans. I'm still going to act like you have long-term debt because that debt has to be rolled over. So it's long-term and it's today. It's the rate at which you can borrow money today, not the rate at which you borrowed money a year ago, 2 years. Don't show me what's on your books. I don't care. It's the rate at which you can borrow money today. That makes my life a lot simpler, right? Because if I am looking at a U.S. company like Apple, I need to come up with a cost of debt today. At the minimum, what does the number have to be? I can't borrow below the risk-free rate. The risk-free rate is 2.45%. In fact, on Friday when I did the Apple valuation, it's 2.47%. So I know my cost of debt has to be 2.47% plus something. The question is, how do I come up with a plus something? I'll go through three ways, starting with the easiest scenario to the most difficult one. The easiest scenario is you find corporate bonds issued by this company that are publicly traded. How does it help you? If they're publicly traded, you can look up the yield to maturity in the bond, and maybe I could look up this number. I tried this for Apple, but Apple's bonds are actually remarkably illiquid. They've gone into somebody's portfolio. They don't seem to be traded, so I gave up on that. Here's the second best option. It's almost as easy. If you have bonds outstanding, what should I usually be able to find for your company? I should be able to find a bond rating. I was able to find a bond rating for Apple. It was AA rated. I'm surprised it's not AAA rated. I mean, you're lending to a company with $250 billion in cash. But ratings agencies have this fixation. It's a tech company. We can't give it a AAA rating. Stupid, but no, that's what they stick with. AAA rated company. AAA rated companies, as of last Friday, were borrowing at a spread of about 0.8% above the risk-free rate. Because all I did was I found other AAA rated bonds that were publicly traded with liquid. So, in fact, that's how I got the cost of debt for Apple. I took the 2.47%, added 0.8%, the default spread for AA-rated companies, and I came up with a cost of debt of 3.27%. That's the cost of borrowing money pre-tax. I still have to adjust for the tax benefit. But he's saying, what if I don't have bonds and I don't have a rating? Remember, 90% of the companies in the world don't have bonds and ratings. So don't be surprised if your company has no rating. Then my work just got a little more difficult, right? There I have to find a way to come up with a measure of risk and a default spread for the company. And I'll go through the approach because I use this even with companies that have ratings because it helps me keep perspective. I use a very simple ratio, a ratio that you might have seen in accounting that lenders use all the time called the interest coverage ratio. And here's how it's computed. It's earnings before interest and taxes, operating income divided by interest expense. So if you take Embraer, which is the company we talked about recently, their average operating income over the previous 3 years, I'm averaging because the numbers tend to jump around, was $462 million. There are $129.7 million in interest expenses, so their interest coverage ratio is 3.56. You're saying, what does that tell me? First, as a lender to a company, do you want that number to be a high number or a low number? You want it to be a high number because it gives you a lot of buffer. The higher that number, the safer a company is. The more income you generate relative to your interest expenses. I go one step further. If I know what your interest coverage ratio is, I can convert it into what I call a synthetic rating. You're saying, what does that even mean? Basically, I'm acting like a ratings agency. I'm saying, look, if I know what your ratio is, I'll tell you what your rating should be. So if you look at Embraer, what is it, 3.56? I use the interest coverage ratio tables for smaller and riskier firms. So there it is, right? I'm sorry, did I use it? No, I actually used the large firm, so that was wrong. So I use the 3.56, right? That 3 to 4.25. The rating that I get based on that interest coverage ratio is A minus. So it's a lookup table. You tell me your interest coverage ratio, whether you're a large firm or a small firm, I'll go to this table and look up what rating I would give you. The way this table was developed was by looking at actual rated companies. So basically, I'm backing into it. I'm reverse engineering how ratings agencies rate companies. Because once I attach a synthetic rating to your company, I do what I did for Apple. I give the spread that goes with that rating. I'm done. I have a cost of debt for your company. So in the case of Embraer, I ended up with an A-minus rating with a spread of 1%. But there's one final step I have to take. And this is a little unfair for emerging market companies. If you're an emerging market company, you carry two burdens on your shoulder. One is your risk as a company. The other is the risk of your country. You think that's so unfair? Talk to a Greek company about how unfair it is. You're a Greek company. You're going to borrow money in a bank. You walk into the bank and say, I'd like to borrow money. What does the bank say? No, you're a Greek company. Get out of here. They don't even want to look at your financials. And after you show them the financials, they say 30% plus. Why? Because you're a Greek company. It's not fair, but the burden of country risk also falls on your shoulder, which means in practical terms, when I compute the cost of debt for your company, I start with a risk-free rate, just like I did for Apple. I add a default spread for the company, just like I did for Apple. But I also add at least a portion of the country. Remember we talked about default spreads for countries when we did risk-free rates? I add at least a portion of it. Why only a portion of it? Because Embraer is able to escape from some country risk because it sells in U.S. dollars. When it sells aircraft, it gets paid in U.S. dollars, which means it can actually be safer than the country it's in, which allows it to escape some of that country risk. If you're not sure how much you can escape, just add the entire country default spread to it. Which means if you're an Argentine company borrowing in dollars, guess what? You're already starting at a high number because it's your risk-free rate plus the Argentine default spread plus your company. So if I'm going to value an Argentine company called San Miguel. It sells limes. It's a citrus fruit. And one of the things you're going to see me estimate is the cost of debt for the company using the sum of the three. Question? Good. That's a perfect kind of question. So I've got a cost of debt. Let me add a caveat. I take this table all over the world. As I said, I went to Argentina, I estimated a synthetic rating for San Miguel. I went to Russia, I estimated a synthetic rating for Yandex. This can get you into trouble, and here's why. This table was developed primarily with U.S. companies, because that's where the data was. The default spreads I have are default spreads in U.S. dollars. You think, so what? Let's say I go to a market where interest rates are really high, like Argentina. The interest coverage ratios are going to be much smaller. It's going to be very difficult to come up with an 8.5 interest coverage ratio if interest rates are 15%. So already you can see that if I use this table, I'm going to end up with really low ratings for companies and countries with high inflation and high interest rates. And those default spreads, they're dollar spreads. If I add them on to a risk-free rate of 15 or 18 or 20%, I might be understating the cost of debt for a company. Not much I can do about it, but in a sense I try to do the best I can with this table because it's often the only weapon I have to come up with the cost of debt for a company. So let me kind of update you on default spreads, because I think people often end up using these default spreads, never asking the question, why do they change and what happens to them over time? Remember that graph I showed you, the equity risk premium from September 12th of 2008 to December 31st, that crisis period? Well, the equity risk premium started at 4% on September 12th and climbed to as high as 8% in November and dropped back to 6.43%. And I said, I learned a lesson from that period to estimate equity risk premiums at the start of every month. I took that same period, 2008, and looked at what happened to default spreads. So let's pick a rating. Let's pick a BBB rated company. That's an investment grade company. At the start of 2008, if you were a BBB rated company in the US, your default spread was 2.02%. By 12th of September, that spread had risen to 2.9%. You were still BBB rated, but the spread had risen. By November of 2008, you were still a BBB rated company, but the default spread had climbed to 5%. Why? Because people were scared. The price of risk had gone up. What did I get out of this table? Never again would I use one default spread and stay stuck with it over time. It's my job to make sure that when I use a default spread, it reflects the markets we're in, not the markets we used to be in. So start of every year, I update these spreads. So the spreads you see on my website should be the spreads as of January 1st, 2017. And here's what the numbers look like, and you can make of them whatever you want. So I've compared 2015, 2016, and 2017 spreads. So basically, it's by ratings class, from AAA down to D. Notice that from 2015 through 2016, there was a big jump in spreads across the ratings classes. Whatever happened in 2016, partly the China problem in August kind of pushed up the spreads. There you go, China kind of explains it. And then in 2017, you saw a drop back in spreads. What will 2018 bring? God only knows. But I'm going to be tracking this number because I need it for valuation. It's not because I'm just curious, but this is a number that's going to drive the cost of debt in my valuation. So let's close off today with one final point. One of the companies I'm going to value is Embraer. Embraer used to be a Brazilian government-owned company. It's now a public company. But it still gets these special loans from the Brazilian government, subsidized loans. And it's not alone. There are other companies in other parts of the world, and not just in other parts of the world. In the U.S., for instance, many green energy companies will get subsidized loans from the U.S. Energy Department because they want to encourage green energy. So I'm not going to debate whether that's a good policy or bad policy, but let's take that as a given. Then in this case, Embraer is being able to borrow money at 6% in US dollar terms because the Brazilian government is subsidizing the debt. If you remember from our estimate of the synthetic rating, they should be paying 9.29%. So I have a very practical question. I'm sitting there doing a valuation of Embraer. I want to come up with the cost of debt to use and the cost of capital. 9.29% is what I'm getting based on their default risk and synthetic rating, but they're able to borrow money at 6% because the government is subsidizing them. So when I do my cost of capital, should I use the 6% subsidized cost of debt? Should I use the 9.29% unsubsidized cost of debt? Or should I do something in the middle? Let's take each one. First, let's look at the practical impact. If I use a 6% cost of debt, what's going to happen to my cost of capital? It's going to get lower. My value is going to get higher. And it's not artificial, right? There is a subsidy. There's a value. The only problem is if I leave the cost of debt at 6% in perpetuity. What am I assuming about the subsidy? That's going to last forever. And that's a dangerous assumption. If I go to 9.29%, I will get a more conservative estimate of cost of capital, but then I'm missing the benefits I'm getting from the subsidy. When I first valued Tesla in 2009 and 2010, when they had, in fact, subsidized debt, they no longer have that debt, this was a big issue. So here's how I split the difference. I did my valuation with a 9.29% cost of debt, the equivalent thereof for Tesla. I came up with a value. What's the benefit of this subsidy for me? Can I actually value just the subsidy? I'm paying 6% instead of 9.25%, right? So I'm saving 3.25% a year. I just took those savings specifically, took the present value. That allowed me to come up with the value of the subsidy. He's saying, why do you do that? Two steps. Governments never give you something not expecting something in return, right? When you get a government subsidy, I promise you, I guarantee you, there's another shoe waiting to drop, and you have to decide whether the trade-off works in your favor. I remember doing this for an Indian sugar company, and Indian sugar was heavily subsidized by the Indian government then. And I separated the subsidy, and they said, why are you doing that? And I said, I want to value the subsidy for you, and then I'm going to ask you whether it's worth it. They said, that's stupid. It's a subsidy. Of course it's worth it. I said, what is the government required to do in return for the subsidy? They said, we're required to sell sugar at well below market prices to all these stores in the city because that's, you know, poor people need sugar. So I said, can you tell me what the cost of that is? He said, we've never worked that out, so maybe you should. Because what might you find? That the value of the subsidy is actually less than the value of what you're giving up by having. When you take subsidies, might as well be aware of whether the net benefit is positive or negative. And this allows you to do it. So I'll see you next week. But if you picked a company, it's time to start working on it. If you get a chance, also visit the Apple valuation because it might help you.
Dylan, nice to meet you.
Yes.
I was wondering, where can I find the previous sessions?
Just go to my website.
The website?
Just click on class.
Usually
say energy department backlog. So it's a green energy company. That's
where usually they have a good positive green energy, and they usually kind of lump together. So if one's getting it, the other one's are too.
So basically, you need to see the footnotes in the loan section and tell you which part is it.
And then if a company like is on there, like green energy company, but they do a lot of positions with like metal edge or something, is there oftentimes or any time you see that they'll get some benefit if they want to use that?
Subsidies all over the place. Green energy. Half your valuation is dealing with the subsidies, right? Because without the subsidies, the company is probably worth nothing. And the question is, how long will those subsidies last, and how are you going to grow out of those subsidies?
Yeah. Regarding what you said earlier about the Asian and European analysts using net debt, why do they use net debt?
Because Pakistan, that's the way they've evolved. That's a practice that evolved over there for whatever reason.
So it's just a tradition. There's no action. So we would use gross debt as just a loan here in the United States, right?
And treat cash as an asset.
Okay.
So that's the thing, right? You treat cash as an asset and gross debt as debt. The net effect of doing that is netting them out.
Right. So it's the same thing, really. Okay. And I just have one more question regarding the interest coverage ratio. Why do we not use EBITDA rather than EBIT?
There's a fixed charge coverage ratio. It is EBITDA divided by interest expenses. It doesn't work as well. This is a pragmatic question. It doesn't work as well in explaining differences in ratings. And if you think about it, they're very highly correlated. When one is high, the other is going to be high as well. So it turns out that for companies, when you look at differences in ratings across rated companies, the interest coverage ratio does a much better job of explaining differences in ratings.
Why the company has a certain rating?
Because it turns out that if your EBITDA is high, but you have a lot of CapEx, you're actually in no position. So basically, the problem with EBITDA is you're counting the cash flow that often is already have a claim on it. When you use EBIT, you're saying that most of the Dodge is going to go out as CapEx anyway. So basically, the EBIT might be a more realistic, more sensible number to focus on as a lender. That's why you use it.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Hey, how are you?
I just have one question about
that. So you still playing on the tennis team?
Yes.
Okay.
I just want one question about modest portion. Mm-hmm. So is it not double counting some of the capital structure risk? If you keep the capital structure in your cost of equity.
It actually pushes up your cost of equity. The reason you have to do it, because now you're going to bring in debt into your cost of capital, right? Which is lower cost. So you didn't push up the beta in your cost of equity, here's what's going to happen. As you borrow money, your cost of capital will keep going down and down because it's the mathematics of it. The cost of debt is lower than the cost of equity, right?
Right.
So if I replace equity with debt, mathematically, the cost of capital should go down.
Yes.
The way you offset that partially is by saying it's true, debt is cheaper than equity, but when I borrow money, both my cost of debt and cost of equity go up. So it's actually not double counting. Without it, you're not counting the bad side of debt. I mean, imagine leaving. Imagine if I left the cost of equity at 10%. I kept borrowing more and more money. Right? This borrows 4 or 5. It'll keep pushing the cost of capital down because I'm saying, oh, my equity is.